All right, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Dr. Bain right now. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and let her give you her background a little bit and jump right in with the behavior cases.
Okay. I think I'm mic'd. Are you mic'd? I'm mic'd. Okay. So while this is going, I'm very happy to be here. I'd also like to acknowledge some other non-veterinarians who made the trek down from Cowtown last night, 12 relatively tall men, predisposed wearing purple, white, and black, meeting up with some 12 relatively tall men wearing yellow and purple in the yellow, the LA County Library, and beat them. So, sorry. I am so sorry. But since none of these talks are on anger, frustration, or depression, we will leave it at that. So, we take our wins when we can. I think we won 11, so we're. I'm going to talk. Oh, that's very loud. I'm going to talk about some obsessive compulsive disorders in a dog, and I have a video. This is Stan. That's Stan's not his real name, but Stan's real owner is here. Stan belongs to a veterinary student, and this is him, approximately 1 month before presentation. Not very funny when you see the next slide. So at that point, when Stan came in to see us, he was 6 months old, male castrated bull terrier, with a sudden severe onset of staring at his tail, chasing it, and biting at his tail until it bled. So kind of what happened around that Christmas time, because this is over a holiday break, the owner came down with her dog and spent Christmas time down in L.A. Around that time, he was castrated, so a little injury in the hind end. Tail got caught in the door, and he'd been treated for folliculitis, so kind of ongoing medical issues for him. And when his roommate, who's also here, drove him up from L.A., he spun continuously on that six-hour car ride and damaged his tail severely. So the owner called up very frantic on that day after Christmas break, and we saw him. He's also had a history of being fearful of new people, so a little bit of ancillary issues. And before coming up here, while the owner was out on a trip, the referring veterinarian had started Stan on fluoxetine once daily and acepromazine, which is just a sedative, for twice a day for that. He'd also been treated with clindamycin. He also had anal sacculitis, and he was beginning to be treated with the limited ingredient diet for some potential food allergies. So when he came in to see us, Stewie, Stan, oh shoot, there goes HIPAA. Stewie, his name is Stewie. During the appointment, Stewie was sitting on the owner's lap just staring at his tail. She could physically stop him from chasing his tail, but just wouldn't stop staring at it and would chase it if he wasn't held. We did go to neurology. He had some pain on the lumbosacral area on depalpation. We did have an EEG done because there has been some reports in the literature of these bull terriers, which may be a genetic predisposition with these bull terriers to be tail chasers. Of some abnormalities on EEG. And with the 12-lead EEG done at UC Davis in neurology, there was no significant findings. Based with on the fact that he did have some pain in his back area, we thought perhaps a short course of gabapentin just to try to treat some neuropathic pain, and there was no change when that was added. Behavioral treatment is what we really wanted to focus on with Stewie. We muzzled him with a basket muzzle, and that's not something I normally recommend, but he was damaging his tail. Period, end of story. He had to stop biting his tail. We wanted the owner to have Stewie avoid stressful situations as much as possible, kind of distract Stewie as much as possible, or walk out of the room using negative punishment. Stewie was very attached to his owner, so anytime Stewie displayed inappropriate behavior, we did want her to leave the room to do negative punishment. However, when he was calm, when he wasn't spinning, which wasn't very often initially, we did recommend that she use a positive reinforcement. So reward him with treats, with food, with attention. We wanted to make it a bit more of a remote reward using clicker training. A clicker is a tool that we use in some cases where it rewards a behavior at the time. It has to be paired with treats ahead of time. So it's how they train dolphins in zoos or in marine parks, where they can't reward the dolphin halfway through the jump with a fish. They have to have some remote marker for that behavior. So, but it removes some of the emotional reward that the owner may have been giving Stewie at the time. Lots and lots of mental and physical enrichment, which the owner was already doing. We continued him on fluoxetine 20 milligrams once daily, and we did continue him on acepromazine for sedation. Acepromazine is not anxiolytic, it is just a sedative, but he, again, needed to stop spinning and stop chasing his tail, and he was on that for approximately 1 week. So outcome, I have lots of follow-up with the owner. So he had drastically improved. He was reported to be a 9 out of 10 in situations, and had gone down to a severity of 3 out of 10. Approximately, the owner would say it was about a 5 out of 10 in stressful situations, such as his many visits to the veterinary clinic. He would stop spinning for treats when he was focused on performing a command, and the owner started noticing a bit of a difference where he would spin and then kind of look at the owner. So we saw a shift. We'll worry about the attention-seeking in a bit, but we needed to stop him from spinning, and really saw a drastic change in his truly compulsive reason to spin. And he was worse at night, and the owner believed if he was bored or fatigued, that he'd be more likely to do it. Obviously, he's not very fatigued there. That is a Mr. Jan. He is Mr. January in the veterinary school calendar. There he is. So outcome, it's been just over a year. He's continued to improve on the medication, very rarely spins, and much friendlier and outgoing. He's actually made it to a picnic day, which is a giant open house on campus. He comes to veterinary events. There's lots and lots of other medical issues that Stewie's been dealing with, namely dermatological conditions, and he's found out to be allergic to 15 different things based on skin tests a couple weeks ago. So that's Stan / Stewie. And we'll hear the human counterpart.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bain. We now have Dr. Michael Gitlin, who is chief of the Mood Disorders Clinic here at UCLA and professor of psychiatry.
Good morning. Let me make a first confession in psychiatry as opposed to the rest of our medical colleagues. We're always, of course, into being straightforward. We have serious picture envy because we have nothing to present. I have no slices of brains that are going to be helpful. Nothing's moving in any way that like a good kind of echocardiogram. So you'll forgive the technological challenge of us. And partly, of course, that reflects the fact that all of our psychopathological entities are defined in the old days, as a cluster of signs and symptoms that gather together with a certain time course. We still have no lab tests, no brain tests, no scans that are even remotely helpful in making a diagnosis. Probably Alzheimer's will be the first with certain findings on certain kinds of scans, but in terms of classic psychopathology, we're nowhere near there. The second, of course, is the trickiness, and Dr. Bain and I will talk about this a little later, in linking animal models and human models with what we think of as psychiatric diseases, but may also be thought of as behavioral diseases. And that's, of course, because there are many aspects of psychopathology that, without having any insight into what an animal is thinking, because they're not going to tell you overtly by words, we don't know about models. So as an example, the two cases I'll present, one is about obsessive compulsive disorder, which will link up very nicely with Stan or Stewie. Remember that Bernie Schwartz turned into Tony Curtis, so Stewie can turn into Stan. That's number one. And the second will be a more complex case of anxiety and moodiness and sensitivity to rejection, things we can all link very easily in our kind of knowledge. But there are other very important forms of psychopathology that are very difficult to link to the animal world. As an example, approximately 3% of the United States has either bipolar disorder, used to be known as manic depressive illness, or schizophrenia. Well, are there animal models for either manic depressive illness or schizophrenia? Hardly. You certainly don't see the characteristic mood pathology, at least that I'm aware of. And certainly making a diagnosis of schizophrenia without an animal being able to tell you about their blunted affect or the voices they're hearing or the delusions they have that, I don't know, the dog CIA is after them, becomes exceedingly difficult. So we have real problems in some animal models. The one that's in the middle, with OCD and anxiety being well-modeled, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia not being well-modeled, is depression. There are some crude animal models that may be relevant to humans, and in fact, they are models that we use to test putative antidepressants in non-human clinical trials, things like learned helplessness and forced swimming models. Whether those really are relevant to what truly is depression, the kind of pathology that affects really about 15% of humans over the course of a lifetime, at least intermittently, if not chronically, is very difficult to say. So with that in mind, we can now start and look at the two cases. And I'll go over some aspects that I think are relevant to the more generalized phenomena. This is a 34-year-old man with symptoms that we'll show on the next slide since childhood. And the symptoms are chronic but vary in intensity. So it's chronic with waxing and waning intensity, which is, in fact, a very common model of psychopathology in humans, and no other medical history was of any note. What the expression of the psychopathology was early on of superstitious behavior. If you think of this as a prototypical case of obsessive compulsive disorder, which it is, typically OCD comes on in childhood. Now, there are lots of ritualistic behaviors that kids often have. They need to do little magical things before they go to sleep, things like that. And frequently, children just grow out of it. A subgroup do not. And we think that's probably a marker for those who are going to be vulnerable to development later on of true obsessive compulsive disorder. So things like not stepping on cracks and don't walk under ladders, these are societal little rituals. Superstitions are societally sanctioned rituals. However, if it explodes, if it is overly intense, if it takes up too much time, this can be a truly crippling disorder. And what this does is it also gives you an insight into the nature of most forms of psychopathology, which is they're dimensional. There are diseases where it's categorical, like the GBM, the brain tumor that was discussed earlier. You either have the tumor or you don't. But the fact is, ritualistic behavior is common in humans in a normative sense. So where do you slice the pie? Where do you say to the left is normal variation, to the right is psychopathology? It's a very tricky issue. The model in non-psychiatric medicine is, of course, hypertension, which is also dimensional, and where you slice it changes over time. When I was in medical school, it was 140 over 90. Well, clearly, the definition of hypertension is shifted to the left, so now lesser degrees of blood pressure are considered pathological. But all of psychopathology is dimensional. So this particular person had classic ritualistic behaviors, checking the front door 7 times, not 6, not 8, 7. The hallmark of all these ritualistic behaviors is they are stunned. They look like each other over and over. It's the tape playing in the head, and they have to be done exactly right. Tapping a desk at night a specified number of times, checking gas ovens. If they're not performed correctly, the worry that terrible things would happen. Now, again, here's the difference between animals and humans. For humans, you can say to the patient, do you really think that if you don't tap 7 times, your parents are going to die? Now, most patients with obsessive compulsive disorders will say, no, I really don't think so, but I still worry and I can't keep myself from doing it, right? There is a subgroup, maybe about 10%, who have what's called obsessive compulsive disorder with psychotic features, meaning they truly believe that if they don't tap, their parents are at serious risk of dying. And for those people, we may need to use antipsychotics as well as SSRIs. We'll talk about treatment in a minute. So, as you might guess for OCD, obsessions and compulsions are linked, where the obsessional thought, which again you can't ask animals about, are thematically linked to the compulsive rituals. So if you had fear of harming others, a classic obsession, what you would do is compulsions that have to do with safety. You would check the gas ovens 10 times. You would check the locks on the front door. So the themes of the O and the C's are clearly linked. There are a few percent of people who have true rituals and swear that they have no obsessions to go along with them. Whether they really have them and they're not aware of them, we're not sure. But basically, most people who have OCD have the O's and the C's together. And the characteristic ritualistic nature is on the bottom part, which is the prayers were not said exactly correctly. The patient needed to say them until they were absolutely perfect. That means it could take minutes or even hours to get it right. Patients with severe OCD may take hours to get out of the house in the morning because of the numbers of rituals they need to go through. And if they mess it up even a little bit, they have to start from the beginning and keep going. In its disastrous form, this is truly a profoundly crippling disorder. One of the other things, before I start on just a wee bit about treatment, is to tell you about what we do in psychiatry all the time. Once we define a disorder, we then try to understand the boundaries of the disorder. What kinds of things that aren't classic but look sort of like the disorder do we see? So for OCD, we have what are called obsessive-compulsive spectrum disorders. There are bipolar spectrum disorders, there are schizophrenia spectrum disorders, there are depressive spectrum disorders. For OCD, and this links very much with what Dr. Bain was describing, is you have issues like trichotillomania, compulsive ritualistic hair pulling that is unbelievably hard for people to control, for which we have no great treatments. Happy to talk more about it if we want. We also have body dysmorphic disorder, a disorder I cannot imagine that there is a link in the animal world, where people have distorted views of one or more parts of their body and they're utterly preoccupied and they keep the plastic surgeons very busy because they keep thinking if I get this corrected, I'll feel better. But of course, it really doesn't work. We don't have a good name for it, is essentially a self-excoriating picking disorder in humans, for which I know there is an animal model. And these are, again, often young people, but it can happen as adults too, where truly it's about scratching and picking and the inability to stop. And what you end up with is the kind of chronic infections that Stewie Stan ended up with, because you keep picking at your skin with your dirty hands and you end up with chronic skin infections. So how do we treat OCD? The hallmarks, the core ways that we treat OCD are here. They're either cognitive behavior therapy, which Dr. Bain gave a beautiful example in Stewie Stan. In the human world, it's called exposure and response prevention, where you expose people to the issue that makes them anxious and you keep them from responding. You develop a hierarchy. You do it a little bit at a time so they don't get too overwhelmingly anxious, and it's a surprisingly effective treatment. The other way we treat it, as with Stewie Stan, is SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which block the presynaptic serotonin transporter, functionally increase serotonergic neurotransmission, And lo and behold, that is the core treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder in terms of pharmacotherapy. Of interest, the pharmacotherapy of OCD, we use similar medications to depression. SSRIs were developed for depression. They're good for generalized anxiety, for panic disorder, etc. However, for reasons that are not well understood, when you treat OCD, you need higher doses and longer periods of time compared to the antidepressant doses and time course. Why that is still a mystery, but of course it points to the idea that it's likely that there's a different biology to the higher doses and longer time frame compared to the antidepressant. And as with Stewie Stan, the patients get better. I noticed that Stewie Stan went from 9 out of 10 to 3 out of 10. Fact is, in the best treatment, people with OCD almost never remit. They respond. They get better, but they don't get all better. And as you can see, 6 weeks after beginning treatment is where you start seeing people get better. 50% improvement is wonderful. Patients will be extraordinarily grateful simply for 50% improvement. 100% is wonderful, but we rarely see it. Okay, so let's hold at that point, and we'll go to case two, and we'll keep on, and I'll be back in a moment.
Okay, I'm really looking forward to the discussion because there's so many corollaries and differences between the humans and the animals in these repetitive behaviors, specifically stereotypies, and what we see in zoo animals and laboratory animals. So I hopefully will get a chance to address that soon. Okay, let's show current slide. No, I'm not a human doctor. there it is. Ah, thanks. This is going to be a case. I will say now the dog's name is Tally, not Sally, because I will say it wrong because Sally slash Tally has been a very continual patient of mine and actually has been seen by Dr. Sykes for some of her medical issues. So Tally is a 2-year-old female spayed Belgian Tavern. They got her at 10 weeks of age from an out-of-state breeder. She flew in on an airplane. They never met the parents. They picked her out. They knew the breeders. They knew of the breeders. They never met the parents of Tally. So they never knew quite how related her behavior was to the potential genetic predisposition that she had to her fearfulness. Very well-trained dog. Very positive reinforcement training methods. No punishment news. Owner, a single woman who owned Tally and another dog, Tenny. Another tavern. She retired and she specifically got Tally to do agility. That was her goal in life. I'm going to do agility. I'm getting this agility dog. Well, didn't quite work out that well. At 1 year of age, she began to develop a severe anxiety of new places, noises, and people reaching for her. She was okay in the home, but still not very comfortable. She's never been aggressive, ever been aggressive. Just a very, very fearful dog. The primary place she was fearful was at her agility matches and her agility arena where she practiced, which is in the Sacramento County. It's an old horse barn, so with the metal roof, and anytime the wind blows, it just rattled and banged. It was the worst was when it was a high-intensity situation, was at a match where she wanted Tally to perform. And probably the owner stress played into this, but as well as Tally's really severe anxiety of these situations, she would not perform. She did stop competing. She did try some things before coming in. She tried distracting her with treats. Tally, at that point, since she was so anxious, would not take any treats from the owner. She didn't see any improvement. Medical treatment, within all of this behavioral treatment, she had perianal fistulas, which is kind of a, I'm not quite remembering this from 13 years ago, general practice, but it's a very painful disorder where it's they think perhaps is an autoimmune component. And she did have a recessed vulva, which is surgically repaired. She had had chronic vaginitis. Didn't necessarily play so much into her behavioral issues, but it's something just to keep in mind. She did have multiple issues going on. So behavioral treatment, we tried, one of the suggestions was certainly to avoid the situations. Don't take her to matches, which is hard for her. Tenny was getting older, so she couldn't compete with Tenny. But as much as possible to avoid going to matches and even just avoid going to large places. We did send her home with a calming cap, which is, and it looks funny, it's like a fly mask for horses. It allows some visual sight of the environment, but it blocks a lot as well. It lets light in, it doesn't harm them, but she was so reactive to so many things in her environment, at least we can block some of those things. We did talk about gradual desensitization, and a little bit different from what Dr. Gitlin said, we really tell owners to avoid triggering the dog's fear. And we tell owners that because we know owners are never that astute in finding that moment where the dog becomes fearful. They don't notice the pupils dilating. They don't notice the dog's mouth closing when they become stressed or starting to pant. So we tell them to avoid those situations, knowing that they are going to, unfortunately, be going into the fearful realm. And it was very difficult. Like I said, she was fairly comfortable in the home, but still a bit anxious. So we did prescribe fluoxetine once daily. And she had been on that for a while. We had modified the dose a number of times. She really didn't quite respond to that. We also prescribed alprazolam for specific situations, so Xanax, a benzodiazepine. That didn't work. We also tried diazepam, another benzodiazepine, which is Valium, in the specific situations where she needed to go somewhere scary like the veterinarian's office, just so she can get over that hump. So since we had no improvement, we switched to sertraline, which is Zoloft. She did see more improvement. Again, worked at the dose, had real close contact with her. She talks a lot. So she would call me frequently and emails. Very wonderful owner. But I had a lot of contact with her. So she worked really closely with changing the dose. It didn't really change as much as she'd like to. The dog was more comfortable in her home, more comfortable in the environment around her home. And she was able to start to go to agility training sessions outside, not underneath the barn. And understandably, the owner wanted more improvement. So we switched to paroxetine, which is Paxil, and that has been the drug for her. She's been on this medication for about 2 years now, and the owner has seen a drastic improvement while she remains on this medication. She is able to compete with her. There she is at a match. So this is a successful outcome. She has continued to work with desensitization and counter conditioning. She got metal sheeting to make the sound. This woman has done so much to really work with her dog, to get her dog used to the environment and be comfortable in her own skin. And we talk about, is it fair for her to, I have to compete with my dog? You know, perhaps it may not be 100% fair for Tally, but it wasn't just the competing. Once Tally got out on the runs, she tails up, wagging, happy, and then she comes out, she says, oh, shoot, there's that thing. But even to this point now, she is happy during her run, she's happy after her runs, and the owner is thrilled with their outcome. Okay, and Dr. Gitlin will have his next case.
I'm above this. The bottom? Gitlin edited. Here I am.
By the way, one thing to say, since we here we are in West Los Angeles, the notion of training this dependent person, your dog, to achieve for maybe your purposes. Does that sound like any different than being a West Los Angeles parent? I thought, why would we even interpret it? It's the nature of things. So, with that editorial comment in mind, let's go to slideshow. Well, we can just do this. Okay. 24-year-old, and again, this is a more complicated case than the first one, which is classic obsessive compulsive disorder. This is a mush of anxiety and what are thought of in my world, my little psychiatric world, as cluster B personality pathology. People who have areas of mood problems that are strongly related to issues in relationships. Thank you. So she's a 24-year-old woman with chronic anxiety and difficulty in interpersonal relationships. No medical history is relevant. And she is a very anxious person. She would overwhelmingly meet criteria given the bottom bullet for what's called generalized anxiety disorder, which has been known for hundreds, if not thousands of years. As they see, these are just chronically nervous people, people who just are nervous about everything. They worry catastrophically about everything. They always have difficulty sleeping. It's a chronic disorder that, like OCD, waxes and wanes in intensity. With stressful situations, the anxiety gets markedly worse, typically when they come to treatment, and at other times they just live with it, and they know it, and their children know it, and their spouses know it, and all their relatives and friends know it. This is not always true, but in this particular case, there are some old environmental events, meaning childhood history, that may have been linked with it, and I'm going to say a word about that in a minute. Childhood history showed marked family chaos with an alcoholic father who abused both alcohol and the patient's mother and basically tyrannized the family. He left when the family was four, but unfortunately, the mother had her own troubles and was easily overwhelmed, probably had her own obvious psychiatric problems, probably in the cluster B realm and in anxiety, and was not nearly as available to her daughter as one would want as a parent. Temperamentally, this daughter was shy. We know that shyness is a temperamental trait, not psychopathology, but shyness can become truly dreadful, at which point it's called social anxiety disorder. We might want to get into that because I suspect there are animal models to that. And the real hallmark of her interpersonal relationships is the last bullet, which is that they were dominated by an extraordinary rejection sensitivity. Now, who, except for the few masochists among us, like to be rejected? Probably none of us. But there's a difference between normative rejection sensitivity. Bad stuff happens, you go home, you whine to people who love you, you complain a bit, and you get up in the morning, you go to school or work or do what you do, versus pathological rejection sensitivity, which is you go out with somebody on two dates. It's not a long relationship. There's no third date either. Doesn't matter whether you're the asker or the askee. And you literally fall apart and you can't go to school for 3 days, lying in bed, watching soaps, eating Godiva chocolate, and crying. That's the paradigm of excessive rejection sensitivity. And again, it's on a continuum, but there is normative and there is clearly pathological. And as you can see, a fight with another person would provoke a truly, truly catastrophic reaction. Before, let me say just one thing about the early abuse for this patient. There's always this question about biology versus psychology, environmental influences. And in many ways, that's a naive or a false dichotomy in that it's very clear that early environmental events, both in animals and in humans, can probably alter brain function in a potentially permanent way. As an example, there's good evidence that humans who have severe early abuse or neglect, there's no evidence that one or the other is more important. There's no evidence that physical or sexual abuse distinguish themselves in this way, that you become essentially an HPA hypersecretor. Your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis goes into overdrive, probably because you're so chronically stressed. And there's evidence that that continues for an extraordinary period of time, probably makes you stress sensitive and stress dysfunctional when you're later in life, and may alter your ability to respond to antidepressants. There are non-human primate models and dog models of this. From my reading a little bit of the animal literature, peer-raised monkeys versus maternally raised monkeys show similar pathology, and it lasts again. It's not so easy to heal once it's been there for a while. So there are ways in which family environment can truly change brain function in a potentially permanent way. And I think that's a critical thing to consider as we try to disentangle psychology, biology. So with this woman, she was evaluated, diagnosed with both generalized anxiety and depression with atypical features. The rejection sensitivity is part of that. And the recommendation was for SSRIs. Again, the case number two, whose name I forgot, was treated with SSRIs. That's the fluoxetine, the sertraline, and the paroxetine. It's very interesting that humans, and I gather now animals, may have specific responses to one or the other, and we have no capacity to predict who those are or why it happens. These drugs are amazingly similar, And it's not easy to figure out why you'd have a mediocre response to sertraline and a robust response to paroxetine. Nonetheless, obviously in the animal and in the human world, that happens. The patient felt blunted emotional reactivity. Now, given how exaggerated her response was, you'd say, isn't that great? But when you're used to feeling something incredibly intensely, and now you don't, you may worry that that's actually not the way you're supposed to feel. So part of the work with psychiatric patients is helping people understand what other people actually think and feel, which, again, I'm not sure there's an animal model for that, but certainly in human psychotherapy, that's a big deal. She was still among God's more sensitive children, but clearly she was not quite as sensitive as she had been, and the constant worry decreased to moderate worry. And it's not in the case report, but that's when you start with psychotherapy to help a person heal from the years of feeling overly intensely, having a pattern of relationships that were dysfunctional. You get the biology in shape, and then you work on the psychology. So with that, let's stop, and then Dr. Bain, we will sit and do our thing. Thank you.
Wonderful. That was absolutely fascinating. And based on the emails that I got in anticipation of this conference, this was a very much anticipated section. I have many questions, but I'm going to just lead off with one and then open it up to our attendees to ask. It was fascinating to hear, Dr. Gitlin, your discussion of the early trauma for the patient, for the woman with the anxiety problems. And I wondered whether, Dr. Bain, the timing at which a puppy is removed from the mother has, whether that's discussed in your circles and how you think about that. I know when people get dogs from breeders, there's a sort of a specific time window that's considered optimal. But I'm wondering if you can discuss how psychopathology emerges or doesn't in that context.
So we certainly see in puppies and other animals, they have a primary socialization period where they're very sensitive to positive emotional things and negative emotional things. And a lot of puppies, perhaps in Tally's situation, and certainly a lot of dogs that come into our service, they're isolated until they're fully vaccinated. But their socialization period ends at about 14 to 16 weeks. And that's the time frame we want puppies to be exposed to many different things. Not to infectious diseases, not to dog parks, not to pet stores, and even perhaps not even to veterinary clinics. If you think about it, that's probably the worst place to take your puppy in regards to infectious disease. But to expose them to different types of people, men, women with canes, men with beards, different flooring surfaces. It's not just about puppies. But the studies out there show that dogs that are not socialized, that are not exposed to different experiences, do have an increased incidence of aggression and fear. So that is shown. So it definitely early experience does matter. It's never 100%. I mean, you could take hopefully nobody has a chow. Chows tend to be very aloof and tend to be aggressive. You can socialize the heck out of a chow puppy, and you make it kind of a normal dog. You take a golden retriever, perhaps, and isolate it, and you get kind of an average dog. So it does play a role in it. Genetics do play a role in it, but early experience certainly does play a huge role in it as well.
One of the other issues about this issue of early abuse and neglect that I didn't mention was, and I suspect you can distinguish this more easily in the animal world because you have more control over breeding and look at lines, genetic lines. In humans, remember, you can say, my second case, you can say, oh, well, the early abuse and potential neglect for the distracted mother and the abusive father, that may have been what caused this early stuff. But remember, this is also the biological child, in this case, of her two parents, who had their own potentially inheritable psychopathology. Alcohol abuse is inherited. This woman did not have alcohol abuse, but there are links between alcohol abuse and other forms of psychopathology. And similarly, if the mother had her own anxiety disorder and coping difficulties, that also could be inherited. So we don't really know for most individual patients what the combination is, the balance of the inherited vulnerabilities versus the early environmental experiences that then magnify the potential genetic vulnerability.
Wonderful. Well, let's go ahead and have, there are some questions. Let's go ahead and take those. Actually, I see Dr. Blumstein's hand up, so is that you?
So I've always been fascinated. I used to study kangaroos and wallabies, and one of the things that these guys do naturally is they spend their days in dense cover, and they get active at night. So around sunrise, when we were studying them in captivity, some individuals, but not all, would start running the fence as though they had to, you know, run their several kilometers back to the place that they were happy. How does thinking about the sort of the biological basis of these anxieties, these OCDs, how could that or how has that informed how you might treat it? Maybe yes, maybe no, both for humans and for companion animals.
In animals, we try to differentiate these kind of abnormal repetitive behaviors. Certainly in Stewie, more of a compulsive, I don't know if Stewie obsessed, we don't know, but kind of this invariant response to more internally driven. Again, we can't ask him. But then we look at these other animals, like in laboratory settings or in zoo settings, where these are animals that are not allowed to perform their species-typical responses. You have an elephant that is supposed to walk miles and miles a day, and they're put in a small environment. Or a tiger or whatever captive wildlife, same in laboratory animals, you put a mouse in a cage, that is an abnormal environment for a mouse, if you honestly think of that. And we see these other types of behaviors that these animals perform. They look the same as these compulsive behaviors, repetitive, non-variant, but almost from an external point of view, or externally driven. The environment is driving these behaviors. The fact that they cannot perform their normal behaviors is driving them to perform an abnormal behavior, which, if you look at it, is a kind of a correlate to their normal behavior. Elephants, they sway instead of walking. Horses, they'll crib, which is grab onto a horizontal surface, and they don't ingest air, but they'll make these grunting sounds. Well, horses are supposed to graze hours and hours a day, and we give them two scoops of grain and two flakes of hay, and then they're done. They sit in a stall. They're also, when they graze, they walk. They sit in a stall, they stall walk. They'll weave, or they go side to side. And so we do see these kind of invariant behaviors, more of an externally driven.
My thought in the human world, again, given my comment before about almost all of psychological functioning and potential psychopathology is dimensional, you have to wonder then, okay, if you have a little case of something, is that adaptive? And might that be why the genes for these problems have perpetuated themselves through generations? When it comes to obsessional thinking, here I am in a room with MDs, DVMs, PhDs, and various other people. Who thinks that some obsessive compulsive thinking and behavior helps people write grants? The link between obsessive-compulsive personality features and obsessive-compulsive disorder, one being a stubborn, detail-oriented, rigid way of being, alarmingly overrepresented in this room, true obsessive-compulsive disorders, tapping, counting, checking, symmetry issues, is not one-to-one, but it's hard not to see some similarity. So a little obsessionality, a little compulsivity, is very adaptive, at least certainly in achievement-driven societies. So you have to say, again, to that question, these traits are there because they're adaptive in small amounts, just like another example, which we just wasn't one of our cases, impulsive-aggressive behavior, which is at the core of a number of pieces of psychopathology, especially these cluster B people, like narcissistic folk, antisocial individuals overrepresented in prison populations, of course. I would bet that if you had, and we do have good markers and checklists for aggressive impulsive behavior, and you tested the CEOs of the Fortune 500 and matched them against a bunch of criminals, they wouldn't be as dissimilar as it would be from another group. A little bit of aggressive impulsive behavior can be adaptive in society. When it's too much, it's not. So that's another way of, again, thinking about ritualistic behaviors as being on a continuum.
Okay.
Really.
Hi, my name's Simon Bevan. I'm a human hepatologist. I study humans and human diseases. And I'm going to follow on from that statement with, what about the dread diagnosis of borderline personality, which exists between psychosis and neurosis? Is there an example of that in the animal kingdom where you want to just run out of the room because you can't stand being around that particular animal?
Maybe I should spend, do you know what that word means, borderline personality? Let me do a 30-second meditation on borderline personality. It is indeed one of the most difficult disorders that we treat in psychiatry. People with borderline personality subsume a great deal of resources in psychotherapy clinics. There are people who have primary problems in impulsive aggressive behavior and in mood lability. A large percentage of people who repetitively cut, you know, the self-cutting behavior or burn themselves and go to the emergency room whenever anything bad happens because they're threatening suicide, those are the kind of manifestations of borderline personality disorder. It is almost, even though it was originally thought of as being, as you say, on the borderline of psychosis and neurosis, that's probably not the best way to think about it. It's best to think about it as an amalgam of traits that have to do with, again, impulsive aggressive behavior, affective lability, self-destructive behavior, etc. Now that I've said that, I'm very interested in you can make such a conceptual diagnosis in the animal.
A conceptual diagnosis, it'd be really hard to say. We do have the option of euthanasia, which... I'm... I didn't mean it like that. The cases that we do see, just like Dr. Gitlin said, they're on a spectrum. And I presented a couple kind of really extreme cases, but most of the cases that we see in our behavior service are not that extreme. We change the interaction with the owner, with the animal, change the household. So most of, and we often don't use medications. But for those scary dogs, there are some scary dogs. One we just saw, it's hard to tell the breeding. There may be some genetic linkage to it. From early on, there are some punishment-based training methods with this dog, so there could be a lot of that going on. But this dog, just you walk in the room and he's lunging at you, double leashed, muzzled. So, I got bitten. So,
Dr. Panosian.
Thank you.
The therapeutic benefits of physical activity in normal companion animals, zoo animals that may suffer obsessive compulsive disorders, and humans as an alternative to more classic therapies.
So we look, our companion animals generally lead a fairly enriched life, even without exercise or enrichment, compared to an animal that is kept in this very small environment that never changes. So the similarities, rarely do we see a truly like stereotypic behavior in a companion animal, a dog or cat, I should say, where kept in an average house. But certainly enrichment, mental stimulation, dogs, they don't eat out of a bowl in the wild. They don't. But we give them food dispensing toys. We give them, have owners interact with them in a very consistent manner, positive reinforcement-based training methods, mental stimulation, agility, different things to enrich the animal's life. But that's part of the treatment plan and prevention. When you come to animals in zoos, early intervention is going to, you have a chance of early intervention and prevention. If an animal's been doing the same repetitive behavior for, it depends on the animal, but generally for a pretty long time, you very little chance of changing that behavior. So if a horse has been cribbing for years, it's going to be a really poor prognosis then if they addressed it at the outset.
Obviously, other than unusual places like prison, we don't keep humans confined in that way. But the question about exercise and psych as a treatment for psychopathology is something that's, of course, a very hot topic. The summary would be that aerobic exercise probably is a mild antidepressant. Nobody would legitimately take somebody with a severe amount
studies aren't great, but suggesting that it has true antidepressant qualities. Ironically, that's probably not true for anxiety. It's less clear that that exercise is anxiolytic, and one of the hypotheses as to why not.
Oh, did mine go bad? One of the reasons why not may be what happens when you exercise, right? Your pulse goes up, you sweat a little bit, you get a little pressure in your chest, you breathe a little harder, which is what mimics a panic attack. So you take somebody with panic disorder and have them exercise, and they think, oh my God, I'm having another panic attack. So reflexively, sometimes they get worse, not better. Not always, but that's not true for depression.
Go ahead, Will. Yes, I don't know your name. I'm sorry.
My name is Diane Costco. I'm a small animal practitioner. I'm not quite sure how to ask this question or to whom. We see something in cats called idiopathic hemorrhagic cystitis, which we know there's a probable underlying adrenal cortex dysfunction. But we see these cats start to have bloody urine when their owners are under severe stress. And so I just want to know what kind of correlation do you see of the human stress causing stress in the pet, or do you see something similar in humans where you see a human problem based on the behavior of someone or something else, too?
It's kind of funny because Dr. Westrup's at UC Davis, and we had students rotate through behavior, and we're talking about treating inappropriate elimination. They're rattling off the entire treatment plan. I'm like, who'd you hear that from? Dr. Westrup. I'm like, who's Dr. Westrup? So she was new. So we agree on the treatment plan. And how owners can affect FIC is maybe not a direct correlation. You know, they directly stress out their cat, but they control the environment. They control the number of litter boxes that the cat has. They do or they don't clean the litter box. They do or don't bring in extra cats into the household. So, yes, the owner does control it. I don't know how much the direct link directly from the owner to the cat, other than if they yell at the cat when they see him peeing, that necessarily can increase the stress. But just because the humans do control the world that the cats live in, we need to change it for the cats. The cats can change it.
Can I just ask a question? Which is there a relationship between depression in dog owners and depressive symptoms in dogs? And do dogs get neurovegetative symptoms?
This one is yours.
So, they potentially could get depression. But in humans, they've done one study. It was a very small study looking at personality traits of owners and their pets. And pets going to a behavior service, it was at Tufts University, and dogs diagnosed with aggression. So they did have certain personality traits. They weren't aggressive. They were somewhat like codependent. It was something along that personality spectrum. Not good or bad. It wasn't supposed to label them as any particular personality, but they did see some link, and they compared it to owners of dogs without behavior problems. So there probably is some linkage of how we see our pets. Some of our owners are very permissive or very almost codependent, we see in the exam room.
One of the problems you have, the diagnosis of major depression in humans is an amalgam of what are thought of as vegetative features, as you correctly said, sleep problems, appetite problems, fatigue, things that are vaguely measurable, and psychological issues, feeling down, feeling blue, having negative thinking, suicidal thoughts, etc. So some of those would be relatively observable in animals, and others are just a little trickier to do. The animal models for depression that I'm aware of, the learned helplessness stuff, the forced swimming in rats, clearly they're not looking at vegetative features. Nobody's asking the rat, how are you sleeping, how are you eating, and do you feel negative about the future? But what they look for is, you know, the giving up, the helplessness, the overwhelmedness, which is consistent with what humans with depression experience. But at least as we understand depression, at least the manifestations of human depression are more protean than at least the what I think of as the limited animal models, at least that I'm aware of.
Thank you. This is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much, Drs. Gitlin and Bain.
Thank you.